You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, spine number 64, Eddie Murphy's beloved Beverly Hills Cop, featuring endless shtick, multiple car chases, an arsenal of automatic weapons, one huge bitch, Serge, Rosewood, Taggart, a posse of pissed off bosses, a malfunctioning Ferris wheel, a super silly helicopter chase, and Uncle Dave! Martin.
Yes.
Fuck Rambo. We're back with another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, you ready to do some Eddie, baby?
Absolutely.
So we're doing the Beverly Hills Cop franchise to celebrate Axel F., Netflix's latest legacy sequel?
Yeah, what they call them requels.
Requels.
In the Scream franchise.
Somebody described this movie as Eddie Murphy's Creed, and I would like to give that person a shout out and say, what the fuck is wrong with you? Because this movie is nowhere near the quality of Creed, but we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah.
First, let's go back in time to 1984 and talk about the original Beverly Hills Cop. This is a weird one developmentally because it really wasn't supposed to be the movie that it turned out to be, because Martin Brest wasn't the initial filmmaker. Eddie Murphy wasn't the first star.
Yeah.
It just kind of became that way because initially it was a Sylvester Stallone movie. It was supposed to be funny, but then Stallone comes in, basically takes over writing duties and almost all creative control.
As he would want to do.
All the jokes out, renames the character Axel Cobretti, and then leaves the project when he realizes that it basically isn't going to work.
Yeah, and then he ends up making that as Cobra.
Yeah, that's what it, like, if you want to basically peek at, like, a sliding doors moment in a movie that, you know, basically never was but still ended up being, it's Cobra. Because Cobra is Sylvester Stallone's Beverly Hills Cop, right up to the point to where they make the Cobra joke in Beverly Hills Cop 2, where you have, you know, Billy Rosewood has a poster of Cobra in his apartment.
Yeah.
And it's one of the funnier kind of in jokes that we've ever gotten.
Well, and it's talk about a moment in time that, you know, you think about the films that could have been, and we both like Cobra, but we also get Beverly Hills Cop, which is the film that cemented Eddie as a star. I mean, I think that you have, obviously, Trading Places before that, and we talked about in our Walter Hill episode.
Yeah, and 48 Hours.
48 Hours was, especially, you know, we talked about the scene in the cowboy bar, this moment of, like, Eddie becoming Eddie. And I feel like if that's Eddie becoming Eddie, this is Eddie completely riding that wave. Like, and he owns this movie. His humor, his demeanor, like, is the movie. Right?
It's him embracing his entire comedic persona completely on screen and then kind of transforming it in real time in front of your eyes into movie star magic.
It's crazy.
Like, he goes from being Eddie Murphy funny man to Eddie Murphy movie star.
Well, the opening scene, the beginning of this movie, and this, I mean, just to, you know, this is what probably top 10 favorite movie for me. This is top three favorite comedy of all time for me. Like I used to watch this. This is a high school afternoon movie for me. Just like had a rough week. And I just like, it's just mostly a daytime movie too. It's one of those 80s action films that very few night scenes. It's mostly just sunshiny California. It's a really great hangout movie. It has a really nicely paced, but you start out the film and you have Eddie doing a shtick in the back of this truck, doing like fast talking, and you don't know he's a cop yet. It's a great kind of reveal of you think he's this guy engaging in selling stolen cigarettes. And then it cuts into this ridiculously long, amazing
car chase.
I mean, the truck chase is just like, it's that kind of chase from that era that was like Blues Brothers, where it was complete mayhem, right? It was like, how many cars can we hit?
Yeah, it looked uncontrolled.
Uncontrolled and crazy. And you have Eddie basically not really doing any action in the scene. He's just literally holding on for dear life.
Yeah, he's in the back of the truck the whole time.
But this movie, tonally, and we'll get into it, the other series, like I think all four films have very different tones, you know? The two that work best together are one and two.
Right.
But this one is such a delicate tone between he's so funny in it, but the plot of the movie couldn't be more serious, right? I mean, it's like murdered friend, which they kind of, a lot of them are.
Yeah. James Russo, his old buddy, shows up to Detroit, has some stolen bonds on him. They go out for a night of drinking, and then two hitmen basically show up, one of whom is played by Jonathan Banks, the great Jonathan Banks. They kill Eddie Murphy's best friend, and then he goes to Beverly Hills to investigate his buddy's murder. That's it. That's the movie.
It's the movie, and what every time I watch it, it really surprises me, because, again, I love it as one of my favorite comedies, but, again, it's a thriller action plot through and through, cop movie, and, like, that scene, those scenes with James Russo, you see, like, also, like, Eddie's acting chops, like, beyond being funny, like, that, I think on the page, like, their scenes together are probably five pages, but, like, they give so much history together and how they grew up together, and you have, obviously, they were on the streets, they were both, like, punk kids, and you have this wonderful moment where he's like, yeah, you went to jail for me, why'd you do that? And he's like, because I love you, man, and it just completely, the whole movie rides on, I believe their relationship, and I believe that Eddie would go and want to save his friend, versus by the time you get to three, while it's a more important character in his captain, I don't believe it at all, you know?
Well, it's sort of the thing that defines Murphy, especially his original, like kind of like early run as a movie star, is that he could have chemistry with a cardboard box. Like, it's literally what he's so good at. And it's also what makes like even like 48 Hours so amazing, is that his weird, you know, abrasive chemistry with Nick Nolte, that even as they're going at each other's throats the entire time, that movie only works because they're able to ping pong off of each other so effortlessly. And he continues that, like Trading Places is another great example. Him and Dan Aykroyd are just so incredible, and another fish out of water movie, to where you have two fish basically getting thrown into different
ponds. Exactly.
And
well, even him playing off the two old guys.
Exactly. You know, the Duke brothers.
Yes.
You know, Eddie Murphy's magic is the fact that, like, yes, he's the funniest guy in the room. Yes, he's the smartest guy in the room. But also, he's the guy in the room who suddenly becomes your best friend without even trying. And you actually believe it as a viewer. And, like, so much of the original Beverly Hills Cop relies on the setup of, like, Axel enters foreign scenario, has to basically fire off a whole bunch of shtick, be completely confident in his ability to navigate these waters that he doesn't kind of understand at all, but he just makes the whole, he takes the temperature of the room and then makes the room his instantly. And no matter who's in it, be it a bad guy trying to kill him or Serge, you know, a assistant at an art gallery,
or like a maitre d' he has to get past.
Has to get past. Like, any of these guys, like, it's just Eddie's ability to be electric and find a connection with the person that he's sharing the scene with. And it's amazing to watch even now, 40 years later.
No, like you said, it's a total movie star movie, and it's a star vehicle, right? I mean, like, the scene I think that really for me in this film, it's early on, that also just shows Eddie's control of the whole film, is that long take of him walking through the police station with Paul Reiser following him. And it's just people talking to him, and he's playing off like eight people talk to him, like, hey, actually, you got to smoke? Ha ha! Did you write that one? And he's just, it feels like it's improvisational, too. Like, he's totally in the zone.
Well, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because that's the other big kind of secret, I guess now open secret about this movie, is that so much of it was done in terms of, like, Martin Brest setting up the camera, mostly shooting it in like medium and wide and master shots,
yeah,
like completely, and capturing Eddie Murphy just basically walking in. And it almost feels like Curb Your Enthusiasm to a certain degree, yeah, of being like, okay, you got to get into this country club. This maitre d' is going to be in your way. How do you basically, you know, get past him?
Go. Or like Apatow style too, a little bit.
Well,
yeah.
And that's where I was going to go next too, is that this is almost like Martin Brest, in his own weird way, is almost like the blueprint for Judd Apatow later, because so much of it is just set up the camera, give your incredibly talented comedian, you know, more or less, like my dad used to say growing up, enough rope to hang themselves, and then just watch them work, you know?
And we had a whole episode, many episodes on the Meatballs film. It's kind of like Bill Murray in Meatballs 1. You know, yeah, it's just the complete setup of him,
or you can like see the other actors with the Animal House movies,
absolutely,
or even like or Trading or Places
with both of them.
It's just Brest has a reputation for being difficult too,
yeah,
or like kind of a perfectionist, and that he has, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but he has an almost Kubrickian approach to directing his actors, to where he'll make them do it, like they'll do a scene multiple times over and over and over again until he finds the take that he thinks is the most interesting, you know, that just has a wrinkle, that has something that pops completely, and then that's what ends up in the movie.
Well, and he has to have the confidence then to also know like what's good, because then you have Gigli, right, which is a huge flop, you know, and a huge critical failure.
Which is playing off of the formula that he establishes with this movie, is because like you have Beverly Hills Cop, and then you have what I still think, and many people still believe, is Martin Brest's true masterpiece, which is Midnight Run.
Yeah.
Later. And like Gigli is very much a play on Midnight Run, of like guy has to get another person to from point A to point B.
Mafia
and
people
go through, and like, mafia people are on their tail. They go through some tough love and bonding together, and ultimately end up in a relationship that's far different from the one that they start in.
Yeah.
Like, that's what Brest does.
Yeah, it's and you had mentioned, I mean, when we were talking about kind of doing the episode too, that they're just the, while it sounds like, I mean, him doing this kind of Kubrickian thing, but the atmosphere he creates in these scenes is so cozy. Like, it's just a right movie you want to, like, especially the first one, you just really want to hang out in it. Like, they make fun of Beverly Hills, but it also looks really charming. Like, you want to be there. And Eddie's just, like, the friend you want to be with. Like, he's so, right, like you said, he's magnetic. And almost like, you know, him being an SNL alum, and a lot of SNL alum films are opportunities for people to play many characters, right? And like you have even like a horrible movie like Master of Disguise with Dana Carvey, right? But that's kind of what Eddie's doing here without wearing a disguise. Like he's still Axel, but he's able to pivot and do, you know, the whole herpes simplex number 10 speech to get into the country club, or to do, you know, Johnny Wishbone or anything like that in these films.
I mean, even the whole long riff with Bronson Pinchow and Serge.
Yeah.
Is that was all off the top of their heads. Like, get the fuck out of here. No, I will not.
I cannot get out of here. Like, and it is that movie. I mean, to this day, though, it's 40 fucking years old. And I don't, while I love 2 is so much more structured with Tony Scott. The action is better. It's more of an action movie. The tone is different, and the scenes, and we'll get to 2, I guess, fully to 2 in a minute, but like the action scenes and the comedy scenes seem much more separated, where you have like Eddie Schtick, really ridiculous action scene. This film, while there is action, mostly feels like a hangout film. What, 3 main action scenes, something like that?
Yeah, but it also exists in the same sphere as the first studio movie he ever made. You ever see Going in Style?
No.
The movie that he made with George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg.
That's a cast.
Yeah, they're basically 3 old guys who are at the end of their life, and they all know that they're dying, and they're living off of Social Security and barely eking by, and George Burns' character decides they're going to stage a robbery. As like, and not even like out of necessity or anything, it's just like just to feel alive again. He has a very similar approach in that movie that he has in Beverly Hills Cop, is that you just kind of hang out with these guys. Like, the robbery almost becomes an afterthought. Again, you want to talk about a fish out of water story. These guys just going back out into the world,
like living again.
Like, that's their fish out of water story. And like, there's these amazing moments of them on the street. One in particular where they see these like street performers, and Art Carney just starts to basically dance in the streets. And it's just, you watch this old man in his like late 70s, early 80s, just decide to come alive again in this moment of kind of like captured joy that Brest just gets because he's just letting the camera roll and just setting up these scenarios for these really great performers to kind of act inside of. It's a really terrific, moving little movie if you've never seen it.
No, I definitely will. I mean, being such a fan of this movie, and It's interesting, too, though, when you think about just the thriller plot of this movie. Not too interesting. You know what I mean? It's a pretty...
I think that you could say that that becomes a hallmark of the series in general, though. Like, the plots are almost identical and barely exist in certain cases.
Yeah, and they exist, but in a very generic action movie plot.
Exactly.
You know, of like, there's no... Like, you have your final set piece, you have... And all the films, him trying to convince the powers that be that this highly respected person in Beverly Hills, usually whether it be a cop or, you know, this art dealer, Victor, can't possibly, you know, he does all this charity work. How could he possibly be behind drug smuggling and murder? It's like, and it's all of that. And it's Eddie being, you know, kind of trying to convince people, but also just being unstoppable because he is constant. It's the classic thing too of being outside the law, right? Like, he's a cop, but he's coming into Beverly Hills where they do it by the book, and more by the book in each film, right? The whole joke always is like, hey, we don't do things like that anymore here, Axel. And it's like it's always been Beverly Hills and all 4.
It's all politics here now, Axel.
Yeah, every
as
time.
As if it wasn't before.
Exactly.
The entire time.
Yeah.
Well, and the Beverly Hills Cop movies, particularly the first 2, kind of beat Lethal Weapon 2 to the punch of making the bad guys these sort of like generic sort of European like bad dudes who glare behind desks and like and in these empty sterile spaces and whatever. Because in Beverly Hills Cop 2, you have Jürgen Prochnow as your main bad guy.
And Brigitte Nielsen.
And Brigitte Nielsen. And like, you watch that movie and it's stylistically totally different than Beverly Hills Cop 1. But at the same time, almost the same exact plot. It's just a different person gets shot and Axel gets called back from Detroit to come investigate. In this case, it's Ronnie Cox's chief inspector. And then he comes back to investigate and try to save his friend, team up with Rosewood and Taggart again, and all hell breaks loose. That's it. That's the movie. Only it's shot with fucking Tony Scott's anti-real... hyper violent, hazy.
Oh my god, like, sepia tone.
It's so fucking good looking. Like,
the whole movie's at 7:02 p.m.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, right at almost like golden hour, the hour where like the sun is starting to set in L.A. and like it's just letting out that almost like gross pollution haze like over the skyline. It's,
yeah,
it's really cool looking movie. Like, it's the look that he would perfect with True Romance. He starts here
and perfect with Days of Thunder. I think too.
Days of Thunder, like here, I put some of his early stuff into two categories. Like Days of Thunder, to me, the obvious extension is of Top Gun.
Yeah.
Where Beverly Hills Cop 2, I think there's two primary extensions in that you get Revenge with Kevin Costner, and then also True Romance. Those are the movies that where Beverly Hills Cop 2 is almost like the building block for those, because he's making these kind of grimy pulp thrillers with one hand, and then making these big,
huge, like, blockbusters,
mechanical spectacles with the other hand in Top Gun and Days of Thunder.
No, that's fair. And
although Jeffrey Kimball shoots, I believe, Days of Thunder and Beverly Hills Cop 2.
He has to, because the color palette is, like, I mean, identical. But something, I had a question for about Part 2, and like, Part 2 is, I think, still one of my favorite sequels. Like, it is able to capture most of the magic, I think, of the first one, while, you know, not being, again, quite as cozy, because you don't have breasts doing it, and it is more propulsive as an action film, and the action is just much more exciting. But I think the one thing that it misses out on being a sequel, and there's nothing they could have done about this, is that part of the magic of Part One is the blossoming friendship, I think, between Foley Taggart and Rosewood. There's something so sweet in that moment where Rosewood, you know, he's supposed to drive him to the airport, and, you know, Axel convinces him to go, you know, basically check on the warehouse. And you have Rosewood basically say, you know, I had one thing to do. I was supposed to drive you. Now I'm going to mess that up too. And Axel says, Billy, I'm in love with you. I just fell in love with you. It's like the funniest but most believable. I'm like, I love that the bromance he has. And then when finally Taggart comes around too and is like, just wait, and gets his fucking shotgun. It's like, it plays a lot of beats you find in Westerns too, of like the guys finally befriending each other and things like that, and coming together who were, you know, before on opposite sides. And you miss, Part Two is a little bit like, actually, you can't do that, but you already know they're on his side. So you lose a little bit of that spark, I feel like.
Well, I want to correct myself just really quick before we move on. Jeffrey Kimball, to give you an idea of what he shot in the 80s and 90s, he didn't shoot Days of Thunder, but he did shoot The Legend of Billie Jean, Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Revenge, Jacob's Ladder, True Romance, Wild Things, Mission Impossible 2, Wind Talkers.
Whoa. So he was working with Wu for a while.
Yeah, what a fucking run, man.
That's crazy.
No, but that's the thing that makes these movies so watchable, though, is that the relationships, particularly that they build with Rosewood, Taggart, Bogomel, and like the moment where Ronnie Cox decides to actually listen.
Oh yeah.
To Axel's like spiel and
forget what you can prove.
What's going on? Forget what you can prove. Just lay out what you got in front of me. It's such a great moment, because the whole time you're sitting there and you're watching it, and it could have gone the very generic route of like them doubting him the entire way until the very end. But this one, no, they team up just about at the midway point, to where these guys realize, oh, this guy's a good cop. He just operates outside of the system. And also, like, the unspoken kind of class thing that's there is that he's black and he's in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Like, it's never actually commented on, really.
Well, he does the whole joke on the Michael Jackson thing.
Well, the Michael Jackson thing and the whole, like, I know why I can't sit in this hotel. This hotel don't want no. And you're like,
I was gonna call it Michael Jackson is sitting on top of the world, but instead I'm gonna call it.
Instead I'm gonna call it the hotel won't let me in because they don't want no. But it's like he does comment on it, but it's never like, it's only in that one bit. Honestly,
yeah.
The rest of the time it's almost like just a floating subtext.
It's just inherent. Yeah,
to where it's like, We know that it's built in. And honestly, it's a thing that would have been completely lost if this did stay a Sylvester Stallone movie, because Stallone is still a white guy. And he's still a very good-looking, albeit goofy and grumbly white guy. Like, you lose that kind of that thematic element a little bit if you don't have Eddie Murphy there.
Well, totally. And you get a moment, especially with Taggart, when they first meet, that is very reminiscent of 48 Hours, where he sits down and he says, I'd rather listen to a pillar of the community than some foul-mouthed punk. That also seems coded, right?
Right,
some guy off the street. And it's like, and Taggart never is openly racist to him. There's still that kind of, like you said, unspoken, you don't look like a cop to me. You know, in the moment he says, we don't narc on other cops, is this kind of little moment of like, hey, we're on the same side, which runs through all four films. You know, it's that constant thing of like him brushing up against other law enforcement, whether it be FBI or in part four, this other task force of like, hey, we're all cops. And it's like this kind of, it's this kind of amorphous thing of what is a cop? What's a good cop? And what's good police, you know?
Well, it's also, he's a different type of cop because he actually is, you know, getting into the back of freighter trucks with stolen cigarettes,
undercover stuff,
and dealing with like hoodlums on a street level and stuff. We're like, what do you think the worst crime that Rosewood and Taggart even investigated was up to that point? Like, maybe somebody's French poodle got stolen?
Yeah, totally. You know what I mean? And that's like, kind of the joke, right?
Yeah, is that it's like a different style of crime that's even taking place in their respective communities.
Well, that's the kind of joke, too, with Rosewood in one and then really blown up in two, is he's this, like, pretty boy who's basically probably grew up around Beverly Hills as well, has never seen any action, and the whole obviously he loves movies, and they plant that seed at the end where he's with Taggart saying, he's like, this is like Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, and then in two, they go all the way with, like you said, Cobra and Rambo, and he's like this gun nut.
But Billy, they die in the end.
But it's like totally him. Like they run with that idea of like Billy's only seen what he also, not just by Beverly Hills, but by extension, L.A., Hollywood.
Well, there's also an interesting kind of subtextual through line running there about a guy who's in love with the movies, in that actually getting to operate with this rogue cop and kind of go outside of the rules and go outside of the law, is that you watch him become sort of like the right wing Reagan era power fantasy that he's in love with in each of these movies. So when you go to Billy's apartment in part two, you don't just have a Cobra poster. There's like,
he's got the Rambo knife
posters. Yeah. He has the Rambo knife. He has a First Blood part two poster on there at some point. This is a guy whose fantasies are coming from the big screen, and he truly buys into the bigger, faster, more oiled, like more caliber of a machine gun. Like, that's what solves our problems here. That's what the 80s heroes do. And teaming up with Foley in a weird way allows him to self-actualize, to where by the end of Beverly Hills Cop 2, he has two shotguns draped over his shoulders. Like,
with the fucking trench coat.
Yeah. Yeah. It really becomes about like these buttoned up white dudes getting to actually play out a power fantasy that the 80s was feeding to them through like the big screen without even kind of knowing, like without ever explicitly commenting on it. Like, Tony Scott's kind of just putting it in there and being like, this is fucking funny because like I started this shit with like Top Gun and everything, and now the whole decade's kind of run rampant, and it would have been another, like, had we not stepped in, this whole series would be just another kind of collection of like white dude power fantasies where, because I mean, even Cobra, Sylvester Stallone, I rewatched Cobra last night, and the Golden Globus credit on that couldn't be more pronounced because it fits so much better with all of the Charles Bronson stuff.
Yeah.
That they were producing, and like Crimes even and Stallone, like, yeah, Crimes and Disease,
I'm the cure.
Like, the opening monologue in Cobra is almost identical to a monologue that Bronson delivers at the end of The Stone Killer, to where they just talk about how many rapes per hour, how many murders per day, blah, blah, blah. It's just that incredibly fascistic, like, Hollywood view of cops and how they should be able to have absolute power and be able to basically punish absolutely.
Well, and I love that read of the kind of 80s action here too, because you get to like the Susan Jeffords book, you know, Hard Bodies, which is the you're getting at the whole breakdown of, you know, how those photographs of Reagan at his ranch, you know, shirtless, kind of bled into Hollywood, and it was specifically with Schwarzenegger and Stallone as the two, and then Van Damme, I think, were the three. But it's interesting too, because Eddie is so, he's in these kind of blockbuster movies, but he's not of that scene. You know what I mean? Like, he's this, he's still a comedy actor. Most of his films are more comedic. But he's kind of playing on their turf and doing really, really well at it. And it kind of reminds me almost of the way the jokes made in Fright Night about slashers, kind of like, we're both making horror movies and, but all people want to know is like a guy in a ski mask hacking up young virgins. It's, you know what I mean? It's like commenting on what else is happening in the genre.
Well, it becomes a thing that Brest does more than once throughout his career, because like with Midnight Run, you have him casting Charles Grodin, who isn't an action star by any means and really had never been in any of this type of movie before or since, really. And like, him playing off of Robert De Niro, who's the most acclaimed actor of his generation at that point, and then getting De Niro to not be, like, he is the tough guy in Jack and everything, and like, he is doing a very De Niro performance, but at the same time, it's the first time we ever get to see De Niro be fucking funny.
Yeah.
And he's so fucking funny in that movie. Like, he has a quote in that I've used so many times since seeing it on VHS, where he looks at fucking Charles Grodin at one point and goes, "I got two words for you. Shut the fuck up." And he's just, he kills that entire movie, but it's Brest's whole thing about like, what will subvert your expectations of like the genre of movie that I'm making here. Like, how can I cast something that's kind of against type? How can I tweak something just slightly to the left so that it feels a little off kilter or fresh? And, you know, for a while there, he was doing really well with it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he made Meet Joe Black.
Well, you got, I mean, and with the second one, you've got, you know, Eddie kind of carrying on that version of Axel. Like, it's like you have the residual effect of everything Brest built in the first one, I think, obviously carrying into scene to scene, and just the way that the kind of the vignette nature of it. But I feel like two is even more vignette-y.
And
it's like, hey, here's a bit, here's a bit,
well,
here's a bit.
It's also in different eras of Eddie, right?
Yeah.
Because
the
first Beverly Hills Cop is very much Delirious Eddie.
Yeah.
It's the guy who's young, hungry, funny as shit. Yeah.
Not a superstar yet.
Super loud, like just totally, again, takes the temperature of a room as soon as he comes in and can just play it to like, he's still very much a stand-up comedian, where Beverly Hills Cop 2 is raw Eddie. He's the biggest star in the world. He's making millions of dollars just to do stand-up alone.
He's wearing leather suits on stage.
He's got those big, bright white teeth now. Like, he just looks like $1 million at all times. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, Eddie Murphy Productions basically appears over his fucking cock during the opening credits of Beverly Hills Cop 2. Freudian Beverly Hills Cop 2. But I mean, like, you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
like,
yep.
It's a shift to where we've gone from here's the movie that made the superstar to where here's the true superstar vehicle with the second movie.
Well, and I love that read, because also you think about the way he presents himself. He's still Axel, but there's the main difference is Axel in the first one is a schlub. He's a schlub.
And then number two, he really is Beverly Hills cock.
Yeah, but he is because you have the opening scene. He's dressing as, because he's doing undercover.
He's driving a fucking Ferrari.
He's got a Ferrari and he's dressing, has to dress in these Armani things. And you know it's a note from Eddie. It kind of reminds me of this. I had a friend who worked on The Watch, the Ben Stiller film, and shot in Atlanta. He goes, man, that guy fucking sucked. He goes, he walked in, he goes, wait, their outfits aren't made by Versace? Like, he demanded that these jumpsuits that this neighborhood watch. It's that kind of shit, right? And I think Eddie was probably like, I got to find a reason to look better. I don't want to be this, like, even when he's dressed in his Axel outfit, when he comes, he looks better. His hair's better. Like, he looks more stylish, right?
He's polished.
Yeah, he's polished.
He's a movie star now, where he's still a hungry young comedian in Beverly Hills Cop. There's a distinct difference. Also, I think it plays into, I've never been able to watch Beverly Hills Cop 2 the same way ever since 22 Jump Street, because 22 Jump Street makes the explicit joke that's playing on Tony Scott's style that he brings to Beverly Hills Cop 2, to where everything's huge. Like, the police station in Beverly Hills Cop 2 is like this high-tech fucking fortress, and they do that joke in 22 Jump Street where Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill are walking through in like the opening scenes of that, and they're looking around, they're like, damn, they spent a lot of money on this police station now. And Ice Cube's like, that's right, tax increases. And you're like, but like, the joke there is like so pitch perfect, because it's something that you totally notice between one and two, is that all of a sudden two is just beefier and bigger and better and ready to like number two has a fucking rocket launcher in it at one point. You would have never seen that in Beverly Hills Cop.
No. And on top of that too, we were talking this off mic. We just watched XLF before recording. Like, this is up to the second, but there's an energy to especially the first two of Eddie fucks, right? I mean, for real, like, there's a sexual energy to his early comedy, and really in Raw, right? I mean, I listened to those albums, Delirious and Raw, over and over in high school and middle school. But so much is about dick swinging, fucking girls, right? And
do you want to do the Mr. T bit live? Or you want to leave that part out?
You look pretty good in them jeans.
Hey, boy.
Got your butt cheeks, rip your dick off. But
so it's, come over here and fuck me in the ass.
Start fucking. But like, he's so like, but there's an energy to the early stuff of like, it's a sexual energy that, what's funny though, is in both films, he has no love interests, like in either film.
They hint in the first one that the art dealer, when they were younger, might have been there. But no, there really isn't.
It's just interesting because the energy is his sexual energy, his confidence, which I think go hand in hand, is he can get in anywhere, right? He has the, you could see him transfer that to talking to any woman. Kind of like how he, in 48 Hours, he was talking to the prostitute. Yeah. Like that super quick kind
of thing.
Maybe
I just got out of jail.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Beverly Hills Cop 3?
I mean, we technically have to.
I know. I just don't want to, because I'd never seen it.
Holy shit.
Before recording this.
No way. I didn't
know
that.
I just fucking avoided it because of its just notorious reputation for all these years that I'm like, well, I love one and I love two. If three is really that bad, why fucking put any kind of stain on the series in my mind? But also, it's a John Landis movie after The Twilight Zone where he murdered people. So, like, maybe I could avoid that.
So,
but I didn't this time around because I was contractually obligated to watch it. And let me tell you, that movie fucking sucks. It's one of the worst fucking movies I've ever seen in my life. And that's without exaggeration. Like, I was struggling to finish it. This eyes glazed over, staring at the screen, not fucking laughing. But then you go back and you read about it, and it's a fascinating movie to read about. But it's torture. It's like Guantanamo Bay in cinematic form to actually watch.
So I grew up watching this movie, and I had not watched it in a long time. So it's one of those movies you grow up with and you don't know it's bad, right? Like, you have to be told.
Yeah.
Because it's like...
And I could see that, too, especially if you're younger and watching it, like, and 10. The whole, like, theme park setting and stuff. Like, it could still be diverting if you're, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. If you're 41, you're like, get me the fuck out of here. And also, can you sterilize John Landis?
Well, it's not a Beverly Hills Cop movie. It's a John Landis movie, right? I mean, yeah. Like... It feels...
And a bad one at that.
It's a bad one because the humor feels more in line with the jokes from Coming to America. Like these broad... The whole thing with the machine gun boombox commercials is Soul Glow. Like it's all these kind of bits. And you can see Eddie probably going along with some of that stuff, but it's not Beverly Hills Cop. It's this weird, bright Disney World aesthetic. Even before you get to Wonder World... It is this really broad, the humor from the beginning, like the moment you know that you're off the rails is early on, is his captain gets shot and he's like, oh, because the tone is just totally fucked. Like he's mourning this guy and I don't buy it at all. Like it just falls completely flat.
One of the best fucking characters in the entire series, which is his Detroit chief inspector.
Yeah. And
Foley, every time you start to think my dick itches.
Well, I love this. I love their conversation in the locker room in the first one.
Don't fuck with me, Foley.
Not today. No, what he says, he's like, you see, I got no ass left. He goes, hey, Chief didn't bite out the whole thing. You still got a little ass left. Like their whole relationship
don't
of
fuck
like,
with me, Foley.
Not today. But you know, it's like, because it wants to have his cake and eat it too. And the third one of like, it wants to be this goofy, breezy, broad movie, but it also, it almost feels like J.J. Abrams trying, what he tries to do sometimes, where you're like, you want to be nyuk-nyuk, but also, or like, almost like Thor Love and Thunder, like Taika Waititi bullshit, where it's like, we're goofy, but then this death means something.
You know what it honestly reminds me of even more? The later John Carpenter movies, particularly stuff like Ghosts of Mars.
I kept thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Because you can
see... Or Memories of This Old Man.
Yeah, another one. You can see Landis being like, I still got a little bit of that magic left. You know, I could still make another movie. Because he had just made Innocent Blood right before that. And I wonder if he and Eddie bonded over making two vampire movies that completely flopped because... Murphy also makes...
Well, and that was after
Is this. Vampire in Brooklyn
That's 95,
after that?
And this is 94, yeah.
God. Because
That's a rough movie.
Real rough. Wes Craven.
Not good.
But, I mean, Innocent Blood is actually pretty fun.
I like that one.
And that...
Is it Anthony LaPaglia in that?
Anthony LaPaglia and...
What's his name? From Wild at Heart. Loggia.
Yeah, yeah, Robert Loggia.
Yeah.
And that one's pretty fun, and that has a lot of the action comedy vibes that Landis does really well. It just throws some horror in there for good measure, like American Werewolf. But you can see him trying to chase that same vibe with Beverly Hills Cop 3, and it's just, it doesn't work. And also, when you read about the behind the scenes, like Eddie was apparently almost like inconsolable because his last couple movies had bombed. He was in a state of like wondering if like his career was fizzling out completely. So he didn't want to do any shtick on screen, which is why Foley feels completely different in this movie. He's not just entering rooms and like firing off at the mouth like what he does in every other movie. And it's just, it's a pretty brutal sit. And then also, Eddie and Landis were feuding the entire time while making it because he basically got Landis the job as like a second favor after getting him Coming to America too, because this is after his trial for the Twilight Zone and Vic Morrow dying and everything.
And the children.
And the children that he killed on set. And he was pissed at Eddie because Eddie didn't show up to his trial, and Eddie basically was like, well, you'll get through it, but I don't need to endorse whatever the fuck happened there, essentially. But then Eddie throws him a bone, gets him, you know, hired for Coming to America.
Huge hit.
Also, it sounds like their relationship was a little strained, which is crazy because I found this quote that Eddie Murphy gave in an interview when he was promoting Coming to America. And you can't believe that he actually hired him for Beverly Hills Cop 3 after saying this, is that he literally said in an interview, Vic Morrow has a better chance at working with Landis again than I do.
Oh my God.
Think about saying that.
That is the lowest of low blows too.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about getting him where
it
hurts.
Jesus. But I mean, this movie's just an abortion. Also, like, real simple stuff of, like, fucking Taggart's not in the movie.
Yep.
Ronnie Cox isn't in the movie because Landis apparently fucked the scheduling up so bad that they had to go on to other projects. So you have Hector Elizondo coming in and essentially doing...
He's Taggart.
The John Ashton part, but it's not... He's a different character, but he's doing John Ashton, which is just fucking weird. Rosewood's in it, but he's... Just kind of like,
He's kind of, it happens in 3, and we're going to talk about it with Axel F, is these characters who, you know, Axel comes back and they've been promoted now. Because in 2, Taggart and Rosewood are like in deep shit because now the new captain's even worse.
He's in it, but it almost feels like he had limited shooting days.
Oh, yeah. He's
it's weird.
He has, I mean, Hector Elizondo is the one who has more like to do with the plot. You know, he's the one, he's the one who has to convince that, like, you're, again, another guy who's the very, he's the head of security for an amusement park, but is well known in the world of security and gets awards at security functions.
Sure.
Like,
whatever.
What the fuck, dude? It's so lazy.
And
it's so lazy.
It also has this parade of, like, weird cameos. Like, George Lucas shows up at one point.
Yeah.
Dante shows up at one point. Now, granted, that's a Landis trademark. Like, he does this with all of his films. But it's just, it's more reinforces your point of that. John Landis wasn't really interested in making a Beverly Hills Cop movie. He was interested in making a John Landis comedy with Eddie Murphy. And it just fucking sucks. He didn't have the magic anymore.
No, it's... And again, grew up watching it, had no problems with it. It was a fun... Honestly, it's rated R, it's a kiddie movie. And, you know, it feels like a kiddie movie. It's less vulgar. You know, the humor is a lot nicer, I feel like. It's... Like more, the action is more stunty, and less like
there is the whole like kind of weird Ferris wheel.
I liked it a lot. The spider
set piece where they're jumping back and forth, and there's some crazy stunt work on that. Also amazing that to think about in hindsight that they let Landis do that after the Twilight Zone incident. That they were like, yeah, this is fine.
I mean, it looks like a really harrowing stunt because that guy's out there jumping between. Hopefully with something the beneath, but no wires. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, hopefully no helicopters involved either.
Jesus,
you know what I mean?
Jesus Christ. Let's get past Landis.
Do you want to get to Axel F?
Let's do it.
All right. We're back talking about Axel F, Netflix's fourth installment in the very long-running, 40-year-running now, Beverly Hills Cop series. Martin, I'm going to spin this one to you. What do you think?
It's fine. It's it's really... It,
2.5 stars.
2.5 stars. It is another requel. It's so... there. You know, you mentioned earlier... someone calling it, you know, Eddie Murphy's Creed. There are very few...
Fuck you, sir.
There are very few IPs, especially from the 80s, that I feel have been resurrected successfully, and I think, or 70s and 80s, I think Creed is one where had a new interesting story to tell. You had Rocky in a different position as not the lead character. You put him in the Mickey role. And you have someone like Ryan Coogler, you know, a great filmmaker making it. With this film, it feels more akin, honestly, to two films, or a couple of films, actually. The Halloween requel for 2018, it feels like really like Ghostbusters Afterlife. And then Force Awakens, in that
Martin has not come here to celebrate Axel F. He has come here to bury it.
But all three films, while you're watching them, are fine. Or all four films, they're fine. Like, you watch them, you're like, oh, it's good. You know what I mean? It's like, that was really good McDonald's, you know, and or that was really good Chili's. And then you're like, the next day, you're like, what did I have for dinner last night? This film went through my eyes and just out back of my head. Like, I already have forgotten most of it. We watched it an hour ago.
Yeah. It's like getting food poisoning from Chinese short ribs.
But it's worth it.
You're just spraying the bowl at the end. It is crazy watching this movie in such close proximity to Bad Boys Ride or Die, which Adil and Bilal directed. And they directed with such high energy and honestly such a greater understanding and appreciation of what made Tony Scott and Michael Bay's kind of manic, chaotic action shooting style work so well. Because, I mean, like, Ride or Die has the fucking ambulance drones in there.
Yeah.
Even Bad Boys for Life, which isn't, I don't like as much as Ride or Die.
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
Has a much flashier look to it than even Axel F. Like, if you were to put Axel F on in the middle between, you know, Bad Boys for Life and Bad Boys Ride or Die, you'd be like, what was the second movie? What did we watch? Because it just doesn't, you can see this director kind of flexing and trying to make a movie in the vein of Tony Scott and Beverly Hills Cop 2, but it just never quite gets there. And the thing is, the plot is kind of similar to Bad Boys Ride or Die.
Yeah.
Especially with, like, the imprisoned cartel dude.
Undercover,
having to go back and reconcile with, like, basically a lost family member, dealing with getting older, which Bad Boys Ride or Die does so much better with the Martin Lawrence character, and bringing Reggie back and giving him an actual arc. Like, it just, those guys have such a greater understanding of what people signed up for with the Michael Bay Bad Boys movies than anyone involved with that. Even maybe Eddie Murphy understands, because Axel in this one feels different than even the Axel in Beverly Hills Cop 3. Like, he's shticky and funny, but he's never as completely unhinged and firing from the hip as he is in the first two films.
Well, you think, I completely agree with you, and we both, I mean, we saw Bad Boys Ride or Die together, and oh my God, like, I
thought you were going to levitate out of your seat at certain points, especially once the drone work came in and they started using the ambulance drones again. It was just like, oh, fuck, these guys are on our
Well, you saw me literally right jumping. Now. I literally jumped out of my seat. Like, I was like,
oh.
Well, and then you have a giant fucking alligator, like, which is.
Yeah, he fights an albino alligator at the end.
I turned to you and they put Chekhov's alligator in there, and I turned to you. I was like, if they show an alligator, this movie's going to go from 9 to a 10. Yeah. And, like, I honestly have no notes on that movie. And I think there's a couple.
And, like, I liked it, and you loved it.
which usually those are more your kind of movies, you know what I mean? And, like, I was just, like, I was just in from the first frame. But I think what's really, I had an idea about beyond this flashy filmmaking, the better, honestly, better action. I mean, because the action is just better in Bad Boys than in this is. And I think it brings it fully to what makes a requel work or a later sequel work in a long-running franchise. Because, yeah, Bad Boys is almost 30 years old now, too, right? 29 years. And you have to – it sounds super, super simple – is give us something that tops the original in some way. And I think that what makes – doing something you can do now, you couldn't do back then, right? So as simple as Bad Boys is – using drone shots, much more action, and you don't linger on anything too long, right? So if you have, there's plenty of lame jokes in the new Bad Boys movie, right, that kind of fall flat, and it's kind of about being old, and you're like, all right, and you, but it breezes past it so fast, right? And with this one, it almost is like Eddie will make a joke, and it seems like he's looking at the audience like, did you like it? You know, it lingers in these moments, and it's slow.
There's some flop sweat going on.
And you just have those moments of like that extra. It happens in the third one, too, in Beverly Hills Cop 3, where he'll say a thing, and it's like you can hear the wet fart of like no – you can hear the echo of no laughter for this joke, for me or from anybody. But you think about a film like Maverick, another late sequel – where Maverick is good because it is going back to the basics, a very simple story. But what puts it apart is it's the most ridiculous action movie made in the last like 20 years. One of them. Like it's doing stuff you did not see in the original with the planes.
I mean, again, like Bad Boys 4, it's made by somebody in Joseph Kaczynski who's trying to push the cinematic language of action filmmaking forward.
Yep.
Like
not looking back, looking forward.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the duo behind the Bad Boys movies are doing the same thing, especially with Bad Boys Ride or Die.
Good
and
God.
And the whole, like, harness sequence with the gun, where it's flipping back and forth and becoming basically like a live-action video game. I'd never seen anything quite like that in a movie before. Just in the same way with all of Kaczynski's kind of mini-cams that he's putting in actual fighter jets and stuff, is that these guys actually care about the craft of filmmaking, where the people behind Axel F seem to just care about giving you a product that Netflix can put on their UI and just kind of have scrolled through and a million people will tune in and that's it, you know?
Well, you think about, this feels closer, if you think of three new Eddie films, Coming to America with the two in the middle, Dolomite and then this, right? I feel like you have Dolomite.
Coming to America sucks.
Yes, you have Dolomite on one end. The other end, you have Coming to America. In the middle, you have this movie, right? Where it's kind of, it's better than that, but nowhere near as good as Dolomite. And I think what's great about, because Dolomite was my favorite movie of that year. I've probably watched it 10 times. It is another cozy movie.
Incredible film.
And it feels honestly like Beverly Hills Cop 1, that you want to live in this world. And Eddie is that charming, lovable Eddie again. But he brings another level of sweetness and of age. And leaning into like, hey, I've gained some weight. I'm not the sexy guy I used to be.
You know what it is too, though? It's Eddie being hungry again.
Yes.
And I don't know
yes.
if it's because it's Eddie. There's the huge kind of controversy. Not controversy, but like there was the year with Dreamgirls where everybody thought it was basically Eddie's
year.
Year and it was his award to lose. And he ends up losing to Alan Arkin, I believe, that year.
Oh, I forget.
For Little Miss Sunshine. But that you can see kind of killed him and took the wind out of his sails a little bit. And it's him back in the saddle trying to go for an Oscar again. But also, frankly, I think it helps that in playing Rudy Ray Moore, he's playing a guy who was poor and hungry and who wanted to prove that he could do stand-up.
Underdog.
And yeah, and he was the total underdog like Eddie was when he was, you know, coming off of SNL and 48 Hours and everything and ascending to movie star status, is that I think connecting with Rudy Ray Moore's character reignited a kind of hunger inside of him. And now playing Axel F., you know what I saw when I watched Axel F. today with you? Was the guy from Daddy Daycare.
No,
the guy
totally.
From the Nutty Professor movies. All of those Meet kind Dave. Of chaste. Yeah. Norbit. Those very chaste, goofy.
Sophomoric.
Yeah, sophomoric movies that, because after Beverly Hills Cop, we were talking about this a little bit off mic while we were watching Axel F, is that after Beverly Hills Cop, and that movie didn't do well, he kind of pivots away from that version of Eddie Murphy completely and starts making all these family-friendly movies.
Yeah.
And then he makes the one movie in the midst of all those in 1997 that we kind of get a glimpse, like Cobra was Sylvester Stallone's initial vision for Beverly Hills Cop. We get Metro in 1997 from Hollywood Pictures, which is closer to what it sounds like Eddie Murphy wanted Beverly Hills Cop 3 to be, because it's just a straight up 3-star action programmer with a great fucking car and trolley chase in the middle of San Francisco. Some great gunfights.
Good bad guy.
Good bad guy. Because it's
Michael Wincott.
And like, it just feels like the movie that he wanted to make initially. And instead he makes this one off that nobody really sees, but honestly, it's kind of an undervalued gem in his filmography.
No, because I watched it in research for this, and last time I saw it was on VHS when it first came out.
It fucking rules.
And I watched it and I was like, I mean, it's one of those, again, late 90s movies where they just don't make them like that anymore.
Yeah, it's not like a great film by any means, but it's the type of film, to your point, that we just don't get anymore, and that it happens to star like one of the biggest movie stars of all time.
Well, and he is a movie star, and it's still, and it's literally that he makes probably 5 jokes in the whole movie. I mean, it is like, it's serious.
He's very much trying to just be a straight ahead action star, which is what he wanted Axel Foley to be in 3.
Yeah. And it's still like he has some lightness to it, like the whole joke where it's like, who am I? Red Fox? They give him like the truck, you know, thing. And
well, and also having Michael Rapaport as his kind of near duel partner and everything. Like, it's going for the same kind of dynamic. It's just played as a straight ahead action movie.
Yeah. And
in the era of The Rock, like, you could almost see him that being like Eddie Murphy being like, this is my Bad Boys. This is my Michael Bay film.
Yeah. You know? No, totally. But yeah, I mean, Axel F is, it also just feels really Netflix, you know? It just feels like a Netflix movie, and I mean that in every negative way.
It even has the Netflix sheen to a certain degree.
It does.
It looks better than some of them, but it still feels like, and I don't know, because we don't know what kind of compression or everything's going through when they put it on this streaming service, but like, it doesn't look, like when you watch particularly Beverly Hills Cop 2, you're like, this is a fucking movie.
Oh, yeah.
This is meant to be played on 35mm on the big screen.
Bleeding color.
When you watch fucking Axel F, it's supposed to be watched on streaming, on digital.
Yeah.
While you pretty much have maybe your phone out and, or folding laundry or whatever. Like, it sucks to say because, again, it's Eddie fucking Murphy, but it's just content.
No, it's... here we are, it's July 3rd, man. They knew it's exactly trying to do this. Hey, people are going to be home this weekend grilling out. They want something to watch. It'll probably get quite a few views.
It's going to do great for them. Yeah. We're going to get an article from fucking Netflix that's going to be, honestly meaningless because it'll be something along the lines of Axel F, most viewed movie of all time
on Screen
in
Rant.
Netflix history, and we'll be like, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
Did they watch it all the way through? Did they watch 5 minutes? Did they, like, who watched this fucking movie, and how much of it did they actually watch? Like, and also, there's a lot of weird stuff in this one. Like, we were commenting, like, you know, Judge Reinhold comes back, looks like hammered shit, by the way. And
he looks really bad.
But like Rosewood, you know what he looks like? It's like he looks like if you put Judge Reinhold inside of the Brundlefly pod with another Judge Reinhold, and they just kind of came out as
melt
like
a, together,
like Clayface. He looks horrible in this. But anyway, they bring back Judge Reinhold and Billy Rosewood, and he's a big part of the plot. Until he just disappears for the majority of the movie's runtime. Like, he's in the first
all of
like
Act 2, he's
minutes,
gone.
And then he just disappears. And it almost feels like they either shot stuff with Reinhold and were like, this isn't working at all, and cut it all out. Or they only had a couple days with him and they were like, how do we get Billy Rosewood into this narrative? Because they also bring Taggart back. Taggart's now the chief of police
or something.
And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who has a chin strap beard that literally he should be thrown in the Hague for, like, he's basically the Hector Elizondo of Axel F, because he's the new partner.
You could also cut him out of the movie completely.
Yeah,
and just make his daughter a cop. Done.
Yeah, and the whole thing with him and his daughter, like, never really gets anywhere. Like, you can see what they're trying to do is that it's kind of like Creed.
It's Rooster also Maverick.
Or Rooster and Maverick. Like, they're trying to do a thing, and it's just not there. Like, there's no magic here.
No, it feels by the numbers. And you made a point off mic, too, that I agree with, and that's it's so by the numbers. The second half is just like action. It is completely a generic set piece.
There are like five car chases in this movie.
Yeah, and they're like the opening one is better. The one it's again it's him driving a giant truck, so it's really back to part one. Playing in the first 20 minutes, three songs from the soundtracks to part one and part two. You have Shakedown. You have The Heat Is On to open the film. The first thing you hear is Heat Is On. And then Neutron Dance by the Pointer Sisters, right? And
now, thankfully, we have Lorne Balfe coming back and basically stepping in for Faltermeyer.
Yeah, as he did in Maverick.
With Maverick as well. But unlike Beverly Hills Cop 3, which had that absolute fucking abomination of an orchestral reimagining of the Beverly Hills Cop theme.
It's like the H2O soundtrack for Halloween, the orchestral Ottman version
of
Carpenter.
You sit there and you go,
what are we doing?
Fellas, what did you think we signed up for? It's not for this, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, it just, but like, I think to your point you made off mic though, of like, and it goes back to us talking about the original film and one and two, which are the better films. And again, are really boilerplate, normal action plots that aren't that fascinating, but it lives or dies by the charm of Eddie, the camaraderie with the other characters, and good action set pieces, especially when we talk about part two. And this one kind of has none of that. You know, it's like, so now you're just watching a generic movie with everyone looking really fucking old. You know, this feels like Dial of Destiny, of like old Indiana Jones, just broken down, fucking nobody. I don't care if he's still got a six pack.
Paul Reiser's now like
the chief back in
Detroit.
Who retired because he had to take a bullet for him.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's just...
I turned in my papers, Axel, and I did it to protect you.
It's like, come on.
Sir, did you? And also, like, Serge shows back up again with Bronson Pinchot, and it's just... It's so...
That was really shameless.
Shoehorned in.
Yeah.
The more we talk about this movie, the less I like it.
Well, it's supposed to... It is, again, that Force Awakens thing. Like, when I saw that in the theater, it's like... They do that whip pan, and you see the fucking Millennium Falcon. Everyone's like, ah! And this is like when they're like, hey, we got to get into this really big fancy house for a showing. Well, I have someone I can call, and I'm like, it's going to be Serge.
And Serge shows up in a Bentley.
Yeah, and everyone's like, yeah, it's Serge. You're like, cool. You know, I don't
get the fuck out of here. I cannot get out of here.
Well, we talked about this. I think I saw someone talking about Creed. And one of the things that Creed did right was how long it makes you wait for the Rocky theme. And it's that moment where Adonis gets up off the mat. And when you do that, you're like, fuck yeah. Like, I jumped out of my seat in the theater. I still get, you know, jacked up by that because it's like, it earns the moment. And this is from the beginning, like, you like it? You having a good time? It's the fucking member berries from South Park, man. Remember Axl F? Remember this song, you know?
Yeah. It's a bummer.
It's
but
kind
it
of what I expected,
worse.
You know. It was unremarkable.
Which is maybe the worst criticism you can lob at what's supposed to be one of the biggest movies of the year.
Yeah. And I remember seeing the photos for it like a year and a half ago.
And I was
like,
excited.
And I was like, fuck. I mean, this is one of my favorite franchises, like especially one and two. Like, and I love Eddie Murphy. Like, we both are big Eddie fans. And
they did you dirty.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Netflix.
Except for Dolomite. You did good on that.
Yeah, you did all right there. Well, Martin, this has been a great time.
Indeed, sir.
I love Eddie Murphy and I love Beverly Hills Cop. What do we got coming up next for him?
Now we're going another kind of trilogy we're talking about with the X trilogy from Ty West. Excited. You've already seen Maxine. I have not seen it yet, so I'm excited to dive in there.
Yeah, because we're going to pair it up with some of my favorite filmmakers' crazier works. But you'll have to stay tuned to Secret Handshake to see what's next. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Probably all the time. she likes to.